listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. All right, you're sitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic. You're on the 10 or the 405, the 605. You start dreaming, if only I could fly right over this. Is that you? It certainly is me.
Well, guess what, Steve? This is a real thing.
Look, it's KCRW reporter Benjamin Gottlieb. You mean like the Jetsons, you can fly from one part of LA to another?
Well, no, but I mean planes. How would you like to be Arnel Guillen?
I used to commute daily on the 60 to the 605 to the 105 to El Segundo every single day.
Yeah, it sounds like an episode of The Californians, right? It sounds like a bad commute is what it sounds like.
Absolutely. Pomona to Hawthorne, 5 days a week to his old job at Northrop Grumman.
Because I live so far away, I was usually the late guy.
And so Arnel came up with a solution of sorts for people who can afford it.
I had a coworker that sat in the cube next to me. He actually was a pilot. And he said, hey, Arnel, you know, why don't I take you out in the plane sometime? And he was also an instructor at Hawthorne Airport. We went out on the plane. It only took about 15 minutes to get there to Hawthorne Airport and went back to work. And it was like nothing. And there was no stress. There was no stress of traffic or anything like that. And I knew from that point on, I said, hey, what if I did that as a business? What if I did that every single day?
He's talking about commuter flights between regional airports all across Southern California. So think Van Nuys Airport, Santa Monica, San Gabriel. Guillen is the co-founder of this new company called Float. And it stands for, you might have guessed, Fly Over All Traffic.
Float, I get it now. F-L-O-A-T. All right, Benjamin. Are people commuting from one part of LA to another in a plane?
Well, not yet, but we are really close. The company is supposed to start offering commuter flights in a few weeks. And Steve, I got a chance to recently take a spin on one of his company's planes. I met up with pilot Greg Landers at the Brackett Field Airport. It's this tiny landing strip in Pomona, which is near the Fairplex. And along with about a half dozen other passengers, we climbed aboard one of the company's single-engine caravan passenger planes. They seat 11, including Greg, the pilot. Now, there's no TSA. There's no security check.
There are four emergency exits, two there at the back, two in the front. Unlikely event we need it, we would use the one that you came in on. You will hear different tones. That's all normal for the plane.
Our destination is Whiteman Airport in Pacoima. It's about 6 miles north of Hollywood Burbank. I check my phone, and to make that drive, Pomona to Pacoima at 4:30 in the afternoon, We're looking at close to 2 hours.
Anybody near Brackett, Bunkin 0250, again, what's your position?
We're just scanning the instruments, making sure that everything's in the proper indicated place, and we wait for a couple of the other instruments to boot up, finish their cycles, finish their self-tests, and make sure that it's all operating before we start moving.
260, from an update on your traffic, 11 to 12 o'clock.
As we soar high above East LA County, you begin to see just how crowded the freeways are, and yeah, it's just as satisfying as that fantasy.
You can see all the traffic on the freeway down there now. It's pretty stacked up.
Yeah, it's the 210 through Pasadena, basically.
Yes, always a mess.
The 210 is jammed. The 605 packed in both directions. The 10 East is a parking lot. The ride itself is comfortable. It's not too bumpy, as you might imagine. And frankly, it's kind of fun. I look over at my watch. It's been 15 minutes by the time we hit rubber to pavement at Whiteman Airport in Pacoima.
So theoretically, if you had a meeting in Burbank, you could fly right to the small little airport here.
Absolutely. No TSA, no problems. Right in the heart of it.
Some other flight times to other parts of Southern California. Torrance to Pacoima in 13 minutes. 7 minutes from El Monte to Fullerton. 23 from Camarillo to Compton. These are all commutes that would literally take hours in the car, even though they're less than 100 miles away. But what about the other numbers, as in how much all of this is going to cost you? Well, right now, the base price of a membership is $1,250 per month for a daily commuter on weekdays. So
Does all of this add up to a profitable business?
A local commuter flight company can be successful in Los Angeles.
Sean Hyatt teaches business strategy at the USC Marshall School of Business.
The average Angeleno spends 81 hours a year idling in traffic. So if we look at the economics, the opportunity cost for a high-paid professional in law or finance making $500 an hour to drive versus take a commuter flight can be up to $40,000 a year.
In other words, some people are losing so much money by sitting in traffic every day that this expense could, theoretically, save them money. Hyatt says that there are other cities in other parts of the world already doing similar things. Take Sao Paulo, the capital of Brazil. It has some of the worst gridlock in the world, and to deal with that, there's a growing helicopter commuter business there. There are also similar, albeit smaller, operations in places like Mexico City and San Francisco. LA does not have the same infrastructure for a vast helicopter network, but Arnel Giang, Float's co-founder, points out it has plenty of small airfields.
Our intent is to fly a couple hundred people in the air for the first couple of months. And then eventually we have dreams of making this into mass transportation and having hundreds of planes in the air. We're starting out with the Cessna Grand Caravans, but in the future, who knows what this could lead to? There could be other aircraft, there could be aircraft that support more people, and the rules and regulations might change.
But not every decision is motivated by economics, especially in eco-conscious Los Angeles. After all, airplane traffic is a major contributor to CO2 emissions.
What sort of attention have you paid to your environmental impact?
Mm-hmm. Well, at some point, you know, the technology is evolving to electronic airplanes.
Lisa Walker is a pilot herself and handles public relations for Float. She acknowledges that right now the company is contributing to climate change, but she says that could change in the near future.
That's the path of the future, so it will become more environmentally safe as time goes on and the electric airplanes become in use.
Electric planes are still several years away, more if you ask skeptical futurists. But there are a number of companies working on this, with hybrid models likely to come first.
All right, welcome back.
Chris Lang took the flight with me. He's checking it out for his wife, who has an employee with a long commute. That employee is close to retirement, and Lang says they're looking to reward him during his last year of service.
Oh, it's amazing how you can go to Burbank and back in half an hour. I've driven this a couple of times to go to the Warner Brothers Studios, and this is no comparison. I mean, even at midnight when you're driving this back, this is so much more fun.
Float is now taking requests for routes between the dozens of airfields around Southern California. So that fantasy of your car rising magically over gridlock, it's not so far away.
Well, maybe not your car, but someone else's aircraft, right?
That's right.
We're going to keep an eye out for that. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb, thanks for the story.
Anytime, Steve.
Well, from in the air to on the streets, the fourth women's march is planned for this Saturday on the anniversary of the Trump inauguration. How much has changed, and how are activists keeping up the fight? You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Tens of thousands of people are expected to gather this Saturday in downtown LA for the fourth annual Women's March LA. And since the inauguration of President Donald Trump, a lot of folks have gathered all across the country to march for advancing women's rights. Some were protesting accusations that women have made against the president himself, some against potential threats to a rollback of reproductive rights, and some, well, a fair amount, were filled with a lot of rage after the election of Trump, rage that took them to the streets with signs and pink hats. But some critics have questioned the relevance of the Women's March this year, with an impeachment trial in the Senate and a presidential election that's looming this year. Emmy Guarica is president of the Women's March Foundation and an organizer of the Women's March LA. Emmy, welcome to the studio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Dana R. Fisher is a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland, where she studies protest movements, and she authored the book American Resistance. Professor, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Emmy, I'm going to start with you because I guess the first question is, what can we expect this Saturday? I remember the first year, 2017, there were, what, more than 500,000 people in downtown L.A.?
Correct. Closer to 1 million, yes.
Really? In downtown Los Angeles?
Correct.
Are we going to see those numbers this Saturday?
I think we will expect hundreds of thousands. I don't know about 500,000, but I do think we will see a lot of women and men on the street this coming up Saturday.
A lot of folks are going to be there. The LA March is not affiliated, though, with the national organization, right?
Correct.
Why is that?
Well, we have always been separate. We put together a nonprofit back in November of 2016. We also have different leadership. We have a different focus as an organization.
There was controversy with the national organization as well that you were trying to distance yourselves from, though, right?
Well, there was controversy, but there was also a lack of seat at the table, right? So when we organized, we all were organizing for women's rights. We were all organizing to advance women's rights. And somehow, the tent was a little too big for us, right? And so for us, Los Angeles, we decided to put together a different board and organize in a different manner.
Professor, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Can you give us a little context here? Because, you know, the catalyst for the initial Women's March was the election of President Trump. What was going on culturally at the moment that had women across the country banding together? Just the election itself?
Well, the campaign started out with these amazingly anti-feminist themes coming from the Republican side. And certainly after the tape was leaked and the discussion devolved from there, we had...
That was the Access Hollywood tape, right?
Exactly. We had the Access Hollywood tape, and then we also had Trump denigrating Hillary Clinton during debates, for example, calling her a nasty woman, saying really critical comments having to do with her gender. And, you know, as a result of that, when the outcome of the election was announced, women as well as, you know, men, people across America were outraged. And the Women's March was the result of that. And as I write in American Resistance, the Women's March was the spark that ignited the resistance. It was the largest day of protests in U.S. history. Millions of people turned out across the country. A large part of that, you know, those millions came out in Los Angeles, as you know, and as Emmy has discussed. And what I talk about in the book is the fact that when the Women's March was over, the people who participated, who were predominantly female, 85% of the people who participated were female, did not go back and sit on their couches and twiddle their thumbs. They got active and they got involved. A third of the people who participated in the Women's March, based on a random surveys that I did with a research team, had no protest or activism experience whatsoever. And yet I tracked them through the midterm elections and found that they did so much more than just protest and march in the streets or give money to people or organizations. They organized and they got involved in their local communities in doing all sorts of activism that turned out a blue wave in 2018.
Professor, though, I want to ask you about the fact that the national organization, I mean, they've suffered from leadership and even some structural issues, too. There have been accusations of anti-Semitism. Do you think that that's led to, I don't know, the movement losing momentum?
Well, I think the movement broadly was not defined by one organization. The resistance is very much a broad-based ecosystem filled with many, many organizations. And I think it's really important to understand that even though the National Women's March group took on the name Women's March, they were only one of the organizations involved in this ecosystem. And so the movement is much, much bigger than this one organization. And the movement, based on all of the measures that I have used, be it looking at people participating in activism in the streets, in electoral politics around the 2020 election or the work that they did for the 2018 election, by all of those measures, the movement is alive and well and very focused on the 2020 election.
Well, the mobilization and the movement we talk about, you know, since the 3 years ago that Donald Trump was inaugurated president. And I wonder, I mean, a lot of things have happened since then. There have been other resistance movements. Take, for example, Me Too or the Time's Up movement. There seems to be a lot of resistance out there. So do you think that changes the underlying mission of the Women's March and what people are marching for?
Well, I think that people are marching for progressive politics broadly defined. And I actually, with my research team, we surveyed people at the Women's March in D.C. So the data I have come from a sample from D.C., but I actually, from other work that I've done, I have a good sense that it's representative of what we saw across the country. We asked people who came out to the Women's March, and I actually have done this at all three of the Women's Marches so far, why they were there and what motivated them to participate. And we found that motivations ran across the progressive spectrum. And that's one of the reasons that I think about the resistance is very much a counter movement to the Trump administration and its policies. But when we've done analysis to understand who is what we call persisting in the resistance, as in participating in protests again and again, be that multiple women's marches as well as the March for Our Lives and all of these other large-scale protests that we've seen across the country in the past 3 years, what we find is the number one motivation that explains persisting in the resistance is coming out and caring about reproductive rights, which is obviously very much an issue that is near and dear to women, many women.
I want to talk to you, Emmy, personally about, and I want to sort of distinguish you from the rest of the group, the LA group, the national group, certainly, but as a woman, when Donald Trump was elected and watching that campaign and watching, you know, what compelled you on the inside to go out to the streets. What was it?
I think as a Latina, living in the United States, growing up as an immigrant, being an entrepreneur as well, there was the campaign, and the campaign that was run by our current president was misogynistic. I've been in boardrooms where the way they speak to women was the way he was speaking to Hillary. I've worked my entire life on event production and I co-own restaurants, very male-dominated fields. And so I could see how the behavior, the language, the rhetoric that was used on Hillary is something that women experience every day.
What takes you to the streets, though, on January 20th?
For me,
2017.
So for me, I started organizing the exact day after the election.
You did?
Yeah. So for me, it was the idea that the most qualified person in the room did not win and that it was because it was a woman.
And so you started organizing the day after the election. What was the first thing you did?
I woke up on November 9th and I saw an event in D.C. I emailed whoever was running that page and said that I was going to organize in Los Angeles, that democracy existed everywhere in the country, not just in Washington, D.C.
Do you feel the same momentum now, today, than 3 years ago?
I think I feel stronger about it. I think I feel like there is more work to be done.
But other people, do you feel this, you know, the people marching with you?
I think so. I think there is still that thought that there is something we could do, that we can still march, we can still canvass, we can still phone bank. There are, most of these activists have plugged into different work. Even if they don't march with us, they are still plugging into being active to make sure that their voice counts. Because I personally think we fell asleep at the wheel in 2016.
Emmy Guerica, president of the Women's March Foundation, organizer of the Women's March LA, which again takes place this Saturday. And Dana R. Fisher, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland, where she studies protest movements, and she's the author of the book American Resistance. I want to thank you both.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Downtown LA's Arts District has been turning into the hippest of hip meccas with happening hotels and restaurants and retail and office space. But recently, there have been a few hiccups, particularly on the restaurant side. Back in December, the Manufactory, a huge 40,000 square foot space with restaurants and a bakery and marketplace and even coffee roastery, well, it shut down after less than a year in operation. And now the Firehouse Restaurant and Boutique Hotel says it's shutting down for a couple of months to rebrand and to do some upgrades. Mona Holmes reports for Eater LA. She's the one we turn to for all things culinary. Hi, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
So for those who don't know the Firehouse, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the Firehouse is on the southern part of the Arts District, and it opened up last March, and it will close on Saturday, and it had all the makings of a success. The owners rehabbed this really beautiful decommissioned firehouse that had been out of business since the 80s. They brought in amazing architects to transform the space into a boutique hotel with 100 seats in the restaurant and right across the street from Warner Brothers' local headquarters for music. And they brought in a well-seasoned chef, Ashley Abedili, whose resume includes Nomad in downtown L.A., 11 Madison Park in New York. Everything was set to succeed, but it didn't. But it's not entirely closing, though, because the owners want to close it temporarily for the next 6 to 8 weeks and relaunch version 2.0.
So 2.0, I mean, when we talk about a rebrand and upgrades, what are we talking about in something like that? Are we talking about a marketing campaign change, or are we talking about, like, true, let's redo it?
Well, you know, they are. They're doing everything. They're shutting the whole thing down, not just the restaurant, but the hotel, too.
So it's like a hard reset.
Oh, yeah. When I say hard reset, that is exactly what it is. And they hope to turn it around into a destination. And so they'll be doing some structural changes. But they're also bringing in a new chef with a new vision. And from what the owners told one of my colleagues, a big name that will hopefully be a draw. And this is a huge mystery. Everyone's speculating who this could possibly be. And so basically, we're looking at chefs that are out of work right now that have a very big name of draw. And we're just going to have to see at the end of it, though.
I mentioned earlier that the Manufactory shut down in the Arts District. Tartine was a part of that, mm-hmm. obviously. But part of this huge development in the mm-hmm. Arts District called Row DTLA, which is, you know, several buildings, 100 stores, a bunch of restaurants. How's that whole area doing?
You know, it's a unique pod in this unusual part of downtown LA. There's not that much around it since it used to be such a spot for, you know, sweat houses and sewing shops.
It was
and
a big industrial area.
It was a huge industrial area. And so it's still trying to turn that around. There's unique restaurants that are already down there. Rappahannock Oyster Bar, Picunico, M. Georgina, Hayato. These are all places that are outside of the Tartine closing and Manufactory closings. And interestingly, though, my colleagues and I, we tend to go down there a lot. And some places are just not that busy.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is it all bad news? Or do you think what's happening in the Arts District, it's sort of an ebb and a flow?
Oh, completely an ebb and a flow. There's some great things that are happening. Father's Office, which was established by Chef Sang Yoon, in the early 2000s. You've had a Father's Office burger, haven't you?
Of course I have. No substitutions.
Okay, well, got it. I mean, I credit Chef Sang Yoon for basically starting this gastropub effort. And they do it very well, and a lot of imitators have come ever since. So that's opening up this week. You know, there's actually a couple of really great places that are already down there. Bon Temps is one of the best spots that you could possibly find. And actually, it's right across the alley from the Firehouse. And their chef is one of the best pastry chefs out there and put together a beautiful menu that I highly recommend. M. Georgina is a absolutely beautiful menu, another Arts District restaurant, and a bunch of it is wood-fired cooking, seasonal ingredients. You know, they're doing some amazing things, so it's not all doom and gloom right now. There will always be restaurant closings and openings, and with these two huge significant ones changing gears, I don't think it's indicative of what's going to be happening, you know, in all of Arts District or downtown. It absolutely is just part of the flow in Los Angeles.
Mona Holmes from Eater LA, our regular here on Greater LA. Mona, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
going to do it for us today. Next week, having a baby premature by 3 months? Yeah, that's pretty stressful. How about getting a bill for more than $1.5 million in the mail? Next on KCRW, it's The Bookworm, Michael Silverblatt. We're online at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast, and you can find out more at our website about a special Greater LA Live event at KCRW headquarters 2 weeks from today. It's been 2 years since California voted to legalize marijuana for recreational use. Our live event will talk about what's happened since then and where things are going. Big panel, I'll be moderating. It's a live event, KCRW headquarters, Thursday night, January 30th. KCRW.com/pot is where you find out more about that event. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Jeff Ruoff, Amy Ta, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl make this machine run each and every day. I'm Steve Chitakis, thanking you for your ears and for your time. Have yourself a great Thursday.